Hello, book lovers! I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio and the Pen Faulkner Foundation. I write novels, and on this show, I get to do one of my favorite things in the world, talk to other writers about their brand new books. On this show, you'll hear from authors who aren't famous yet, but probably will be. Remember, you heard them here first. Speaking of which, back in 2024, I spoke with Marjan Kamali about her novel, The Lion Women of Tehran. That book hit the New York Times bestseller list in paperback. Congratulations, Marjan. You can catch that conversation on the NHPR website or wherever you get your podcasts. Today, we have a two-part show. First up, I'm excited to introduce you to debut novelist Katie Yee and her book, Maggie, or A Man and a Woman Walk into a Bar. Later in the hour, we'll talk to Vanessa Lilly about her latest Sid Walker novel, The Bone Thief. Let's get started with Katie Yee. Katie, welcome to Check This Out. I'm thrilled to have you here.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you, Rachel, for that phenomenal introduction. No pressure, but I hope you're right about the whole getting famous part.
Well, thank you for joining us. I absolutely loved your novel, Maggie, or A Man and a Woman Walk into a Bar. It's a long title, so I'm just going to call it Maggie.
Yes, that's what I've been calling it, too.
Okay, great. So we're going to call it Maggie, which is kind of funny, and we'll get into why, because Maggie becomes a nickname for many things in the book as well. And it's also a really short book. It was just 200 pages.
Yes. I pretty much only wrote short stories before this, and I would always joke that I didn't have the attention span to write a novel. So I think when it came time to actually sit down and do the thing, a lot of my process was just Googling minimum number of words for a novel.
Really? I mean, it's so short, but it's so powerful, and it's funny, and it's sad. Tell us in your own words what this book is about.
So Maggie, or A Man and a Woman Walk into a Bar, tells the story of an unnamed narrator who finds out that her husband is having an affair with a white woman named Maggie, and then immediately after that, she gets diagnosed with breast cancer. And I know that that sounds bleak, but, you know, people tell me that this is a funny novel. I like to think that she embraces the situation with a good dose of humor. She names the tumor after her husband's lover, Maggie, and she starts talking to it. But it's really a book about the people and the stories that we lean on when everything else feels too heavy.
Yes, there really are some deep and hard parts to this book, but also some very funny ones. Katie, can you read to us to introduce us to your book, Maggie?
Sure, I'm just going to read from the very beginning. I was folding linens when I first found out my children don't think I'm funny. I was by the hall closet, overhearing them asking my husband for a bedtime story. This was after I'd already read them Where the Wild Things Are, a book they used to love so much the pages were starting to pull from their binding. He reminded them of this, a good husband, and they told him, "You'd tell it better." And so he did, a better father. The thing I noticed that was peculiar about my husband's telling is that the characters are all out of sorts. Max doesn't sail away from his room in the usual boat. A bald boy named Harold shows up, paddling past in an ill-drawn dinghy, clutching a purple crayon. As my husband tells it, they sail off together, but lose their way. They float for what feels like days until they happen upon an island they come to know as Neverland, where a ragtag gang of boys their age pulls them in. They were lost boys all along. Go figure.
So this book opens with an unnamed narrator who walks into a restaurant with her husband, Sam, and the two of them, it's an all-you-can-eat buffet, and she's piling on the samosas, and he just blurts out, "I'm having an affair." Tell me about that moment and how you came to that scene.
Okay, honestly, the real-life answer is that I had really wanted to order Indian food for dinner that night, and I was just trying to justify ordering that kind of takeout, and so I was writing the scene as I myself was gorging on samosas. But I think within the bounds of the novel, I knew I wanted to have all of these bad things happen kind of up front, right? It's not a spoiler. It's in the jacket copy. It's really early on in the story. And I thought, you know, an all-you-can-eat buffet is such a weird place to break such bad news to someone. I think that's where a little bit of the humor comes in, is the unique setting for this kind of news.
Yeah, I mean, this is what really hooked me. It was like, this is really bad news. Her husband's saying he's having an affair, and she's obsessed with the samosas. And there was something, you know, very real about that, in that when you're in the moment getting the bad news, you kind of want to skip over it, I think. And it's like, well, I'm going to get some more samosas. Like, maybe this isn't really happening. So tell us about this narrator. Who is she? She doesn't have a name, but she certainly has a lot going on. So tell us about her.
Yes, she doesn't have a name. I would say that the primary markers of her identity, what she would probably say if you asked her to describe herself, would be mother of two beautiful children, devoted wife, best friend to a wonderful gal named Darlene. I took this social psychology class once in college where they make you kind of write your name in the middle of a piece of paper, and then you have all these concentric circles kind of radiating out, and you're supposed to write a different identity marker on each circle. And the idea being that, like, the first ones that you think of, you'll write closest to your name. And I think for her, an exercise like this would kind of garner all of the relationships that she has to other people first. I think that's how she would primarily define herself.
And she's also Chinese American.
Yes, she is Chinese American. Daughter would definitely be another thing that she would write down. Her mother, she lost her to breast cancer before this story begins. And I would also say that she's an avid storyteller.
Yeah, for sure. So the narrator is Chinese American and her husband Sam is white. So there is a racial element, but race wasn't really the central part of the book. It was just, you know, she just happens to be Chinese American. He just happens to be white for the most part. That's how I read it. And that seemed very purposeful. And I just wanted to ask you about what you were thinking about race as you wrote the book and that character.
I mean, I feel like I shied away from even including race in my writing for such a long time. I think, like, growing up in high school, you know, the only books that we really got to read by Asian Americans, the only one I could think of is Amy Tan's The Joy Luck Club. And that kind of, you know, immigration story that didn't really resonate with me. You know, my grandparents immigrated here when they were in their 30s. My mom was born in Hong Kong, but immigrated here when she was 3. My dad was born here. And so I was, I think, trying to think of a different way to talk about race that looked different from the stories, the only very limited, narrow sliver of stories that I had been offered when I was growing up about how to write about race. So I did definitely want it to be present, but not central to the story.
So then when your narrator hears that her husband is having an affair, she starts imagining this woman, who's Maggie, that's her name, and she's wondering what she looks like. And that's when we really start to hear about race. Is she white? Is she Asian? Is she, you know, what does she look like? So can you tell us about what's going on in her head in relation to that?
I mean, as she finds out when she is, you know, stalking Maggie on LinkedIn, she is indeed a white woman. And I think for our narrator, that really caused a lot of questioning of, you know, did Sam feel like he had chosen wrong in marrying an Asian American woman? Would he rather have married someone who looked a little bit more like him, who shares a similar socioeconomic background? You can't really talk about race without talking about class. And I think in the case of this story, Maggie kind of shares a similar upbringing to Sam. He grew up quite wealthy. Our narrator did not. And I think that's all part of it. But I think in anytime you're going through heartbreak, I think you just comb through every moment and every bit of yourself and kind of wonder, you know, like, what was it? Was there a particular moment or a character trait about me that she has that I don't?
Yeah. So your narrator, you know, Google stalks like Maggie and tries to find out everything that she can, but she doesn't actually ask her husband or ex-husband, Sam. She doesn't say to him, what was it? And it's like she didn't have the courage, or she didn't want him to say what it was. But I wanted to ask you, why didn't the narrator ask her husband, ask Sam, what was it? Where did we break?
I think for her, she grew up, the way that her mother raised her was to kind of be pretty stoic, right? There are some emotions that you can wear on your sleeve, that you can have in public, and there are some that I think you really keep to yourself. And I think the moment that he conveys that he has had an affair and that he's leaving her, he kind of leaves the inner circle, right? He becomes kind of the public. And so I think for her, keeping some of these emotions and these really vulnerable questions concealed is for her part of moving on.
And also the voice or the writing style of this book, Maggie, really reflected, I thought, her inner thoughts and the way she was dealing with this, because it's not a linear narrative. Can you talk about that voice?
Thank you for saying that. I mean, when I first started writing Maggie and she was a draft, and when she had grown from a short story that kind of kept getting bigger, some of the advice that I had gotten that I'm kind of glad that I ignored was that I should add chapter markers, or I should make like time and place a little bit more clear throughout. But for me, I really wanted to mimic the feeling of grief, right? And I think like when the rug is pulled out from under you in life, it does kind of feel like you're free falling, right? And like the story kind of just keeps hitting you in waves, in sections large and small. I think when you encounter like a chapter break in a story, that's kind of the author saying, you have permission to put this story down for a little bit. And I think that if we're thinking about mimicking the way that this actually feels to live it, I wanted you to have no, you know, natural breathers.
Katie, so your unnamed narrator, she's sitting at the restaurant with her huge pile of samosas, and she hears that her husband is having an affair, and her thoughts start to float. And we find out a little bit later that she has a pain in her chest that is actually metaphorical, but also actually physical. She has cancer. And at one point, she's talking to her friend about it. And I wanted to ask you to read this section so that we can hear how this book floats and how it really reflects what's happening in her head. Would you read for us?
Sure. She asks if she can touch it, to see if it feels like a grape, the way they say it will. It doesn't. It feels like a lump, the thing that gets caught in your throat when someone you love says something terrible. I pin down the spot for her, the way I will for all our friends who will ask, who spin my life into their own cautionary tale. Feel it here. Here is the hard part. The language of these big life moments isn't quite right. The way we talk about people who have lost their lives. The battle against a cruel disease. A war in which there are no real winners. If you die of cancer, does it make you a loser? It implies a lack of strength, or otherwise a kind of carelessness I cannot reckon with. It robs you of your agency in a way that reminds me of losing your virginity. My college put on its own version of the vagina monologues, and my submission went something like, I didn't lose my virginity, I know exactly where I put it. There are so many people that come with sickness, so many doctors and nurses and specialists and second opinions, pharmacists and insurance representatives, waiting room acquaintances and support groups and friends who want you to call their friends who've been through the same thing. I barely like meeting new people under normal circumstances, so one can imagine the social anxiety that comes with this too.
Katie, thank you so much for reading. I love this section because, well, it's beautifully written. There's some really, really deep ideas in there, but also it illustrates the tone of this book. I feel like I'm inside of your narrator's head. It starts with someone asking to touch the lump that they found in her breast, and then what that makes her think about, and also keeps us in that moment. Because in real life, our minds aren't linear, right? We are floating everywhere.
Exactly. I often joke that if I could just be a mind, you know, kind of wandering from room to room, I would be. I'm not very good at having a body. And that's kind of where so much of this novel started from, is thinking about how strange it is to have a body and how there are so many moments in life, and in particular a woman's life, that really force you back into your body, right? So moments like getting screened for breast cancer, that would be a primary example.
Yeah. Having children.
Having children, you know, the experience of childbirth, and then kind of all the very physical moments that come after that.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. And my guest today is Katie Yee. We're talking about her brand new debut novel, Maggie, or A Man and a Woman Walk Into a Bar. So let's talk about Maggie. Tell us about Maggie, because we don't really see her for more than a few pages in this book, and yet she's in like every single page.
She is. So Maggie, the person, I'm assuming you mean, is the person that her husband, Sam, is having an affair with. They meet through work. So our narrator and her best friend, Darlene, stalk her on the internet. They see her LinkedIn photo, and she's this, you know, beautiful, thin, white woman who, you know, is wearing like a black turtleneck in her LinkedIn profile picture. And I think they make some joke that's like she looks like Elizabeth Holmes, who's trying to look like Steve Jobs. But I didn't really want to put her so much in the novel because this really isn't her story. You meet her like very briefly towards the end of the book. I think I kept her kind of in the margins because I wanted our narrator and her preoccupations and her emotions to take the forefront.
But we hear her name all the time because the narrator names her tumor Maggie and starts talking to Maggie. Talk about that conversation that she's having with that Maggie persona in her head.
She does start talking to it. And this is kind of her way of like taking the wheel, right? Taking the reins back in her own life. It's kind of her way of saying, you know, Sam can have his Maggie, I can have mine. Sam can have his secrets and his life that he's decided that he wants, and I can also have my own secrets. She doesn't end up telling Sam, at least within the confines of this story, that she is diagnosed with breast cancer. And I think for her, that's really empowering. You know, she doesn't want him to confuse the pity that he might feel in this circumstance with love. And she's kind of like, he's made his decision about the way that he wants to live his life. And now he doesn't get to know this like really vulnerable, really big part of mine. So she does start talking to Maggie, and Maggie kind of becomes this, in a weird way, this like confidant and this enemy and this buddy, like all rolled into one. She talks to Maggie in particular when she's home alone, when the kids are off with their grandparents or when her ex-husband has them, and she's feeling kind of lonely. And I think talking to Maggie is this really interesting way of filling the void and kind of processing things that she's going through. So an example of something that she might say to Maggie is she'll eat a salad and she'll say, look, I'm doing something really healthy. Like, we're going to eviscerate you, Maggie.
And she also makes a guide to her husband for Maggie.
She does. She does. For me, a lot of that came from the question of what do you do with all of these really weird details that you have in your mind of someone who you've really loved and who's maybe no longer present in your life? Allergies and, you know, childhood fun facts and anecdotes and things that you kind of just collect from other people who you get to know really intimately. Like, what happens to that information? And I think for our narrator, she kind of just wanted to put them in one place. And she jokes about giving this user's guide to my husband, to Maggie.
Yeah. So she keeps it all very internal, right? Her conversations with Maggie, this user guide to her husband. And I can feel a lot of anger simmering, but there's no outburst. There's no point where she flips the table or throws the glass or yells at Sam or anything. Why? Why did you decide to write the story this way?
I think that kind of goes back to her upbringing and the way that her mother taught her that strength really looks more like you deal with it yourself, you keep these emotions to yourself, you don't show that vulnerability on the outside. I think the closest she gets and the most, you know, true version of herself that she is with her best friend Darlene. But other than that, I think, you know, for her, so much of taking control of the story does have to do with keeping these floating emotions kind of close to the chest.
Let's talk about Darlene, because we haven't gone there, and I loved her character. She was really fun. She's got a dog. She totes around everywhere. Tell us about Darlene.
Darlene was my absolute favorite character to write, if I'm allowed to say that. Darlene came in because I feel like I had read and loved and been inspired by so many incredible, like, quote-unquote divorce novels, right? I'm thinking of like Jenny Offal's Department of Speculation. I'm thinking of Weike Wang's Chemistry. And every time I read a novel like that, I'm usually like, but where is her best friend? Because I'm really lucky. And in my life, I've never had to go through anything truly awful all alone. I have an incredible group of best friends who I can always rely on. And I have kind of put bits and pieces of all of them into the character of Darlene. And it was such a pleasure to spend time with them on the page in that way. And I think Darlene really does become, maybe in a way that I wasn't even expecting at the beginning, like a huge, I mean, obviously she's a huge character in the book. I think when Maggie started as a short story, it was much more like claustrophobic to the marriage and the marriage falling apart and kind of the loneliness that she's dealing with after that. I mean, even the kids kind of came as a surprise to me as I kept writing.
If you're just joining us, I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. Right now, we're talking to Katie Yee about her new novel, Maggie, or A Man and a Woman Walk Into a Bar. Later in the hour, we'll speak to Vanessa Lilly about her latest, The Bone Thief.
Katie, you just mentioned that this book actually started as a short story. How did it become a novel?
Great question. It started as a short story because that is kind of the primary mode of writing that I kind of grew up in. But she's funny. She's unlike, I keep calling the novel she, but she's unlike anything that I have ever written. Most of my writing is more in the realm of like magical realism, something surreal and otherworldly usually happens. And when I started Maggie as a short story, I set up this little challenge for myself where I was like, okay, no more magic. You are restricted to the rules of the real world, because I wanted to see what I would reach for instead. And that ended up being humor and mythology. And I think those two things are really interesting replacements, because I think humor and storytelling can kind of accomplish something similar to magic.
It's interesting that we're talking about this as starting as a short story, because I'm going back to The Voice. You're making me think about The Voice in this novel, which is what drew me in. I have a really tough question for you, but I want to ask it because Joyce Carol Oates, an author that I love, I was surprised to read that she thinks that this sort of voice is not a real type of novel. She looked down on this type of writing, but you've pulled it off beautifully. And I'm wondering if you thought about that, if you've heard that criticism or read her criticism of this style, and sort of if you've thought about that.
I mean, I guess to that, I would just say like the novels that I had just mentioned as like quote unquote divorce novels that I've taken like such big inspiration from. I mean, Department of Speculation, I think, was one of the big breakout novels to have this kind of more fragmented narrative format. And I think, again, if you're doing it intentionally, like with a purpose. I had considered having, you know, chapters and, you know, maybe more of a solid like beginning, middle, and end. But to me, that didn't really feel the way that life feels. You know, this does feel a little bit more like a slice of life. Like you said, we're kind of just floating through all of her thoughts. There are lists in there. I mean, not even just lists of things about her ex-husband that she's thinking about, but like even lists about her children's current like likes and dislikes. And I think so much of the way that I go through the world is kind of, you know, in lists, thinking about this, walking through the park, but it reminds me of this. And I just wanted to see if I could capture that on the page.
So did it take just tons and tons of drafts to pull this off? What was the writing process to make this conversational, fragmented rhythm work?
I write pretty much by hand always, and I write and I rewrite and I edit by hand, and it doesn't go into the computer until it is worded pretty much exactly the way that I want it to be worded. And that does mean that a lot of my writing process in drafting is writing the same section or the same thoughts over and over again. And something that I like to do is I don't look back. So pretty much things that I remember are worthy of like going into the actual like final version. But maybe there's something about that kind of like repetition and that kind of wandering around the drafts and circling around all of the sentences in my own process that is maybe mirrored in the way that it came out.
And then, I mean, I'm just trying to wrap my head around this because I'm a very different kind of writer. I like, you know, the beginning, middles, and ends. I don't, like, I couldn't do this, but I loved reading it. So I'm just trying to figure out, did you have a ton of readers also help you to say this is working, this isn't working here?
I never got my MFA, which I feel a great amount of self-consciousness about. I had always wanted to go back to school and get one. And then I think at the time that I was starting to think about it, the pandemic hit. So I don't have like a primary group of like writer friends in that way. I do have a best friend from undergrad, and she writes creative nonfiction. So it's fun because we send each other work, but it's like very different from what we're each working on. And that's a really fun muscle to kind of work with. But I will say that when I started taking this novel really, really seriously, I had the incredible fortune of falling into a couple of fellowships. So with like the Center for Fiction, Kundiman, and the Asian American Writers Workshop, I got so lucky. I got, after applying to all of those for many, many, many years and getting very nice rejections, I happened to get all of them within the same like 2-year time period.
That's incredible.
Thank you. Well, I feel really lucky. And I also feel the need to, again, reiterate, like I had applied to each of those like 4 times before I got them.
That is totally the way it goes.
Yeah, rejection, big part of the process. 2 of the fellowships that I just mentioned are geared towards emerging Asian American writers. Before this, I had been pretty shy about writing about race. And there was something about being surrounded by these writers that were kind of grappling with the same questions, right? How to write about race without making it all about race? How to include it in a way that is, again, present but not central to the story? And there was something about, yeah, just working with all these other writers who had the same questions as me that gave me the permission or like the courage to start writing about race in this way.
If you're just joining us, I'm Rachel Barenbaum. My guest today is Katie Yee, and we are talking about her brand new debut novel, Maggie, or A Man and a Woman Walk Into a Bar. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. Katie, let's talk about storytelling within the story, sort of meta a little bit here, but there's a lot about storytelling, and we get a lot of Chinese fairy tales, folklore woven in, and it really starts with bedtime for the children. Talk to us about those story times and how you thought about weaving in stories.
Yeah. The whole reason that I wanted to become a writer is because I grew up hearing just like incredible bedtime stories, campfire stories. I'm really lucky. I never went to bed without a bedtime story. My mom is like a big advocate of reading, of books, and she instilled in me this love of stories. And she was also a classics major in undergrad, so she really loved like Greek and Roman mythology. And I got, like, I would say the PG version of a lot of those myths as bedtime stories. And then kind of alongside that, I did get some Chinese myths from her and from my grandmother. And every single myth that's in this book is a myth that was told to me when I was a kid, pretty much, you know, written as it was told to me. And what's been really fun about this process is people will DM me and they'll be like, oh, I heard, you know, this myth when I was a kid, but this is how my mom told it to me. And myths are so fun because they're so malleable, right? They change depending on who's telling it and who's hearing it and how you remember it and what you're going through at the time. So I thought they were a really fun way to incorporate this bit of culture that our narrator is trying to instill in our children. I think part of the reason that she starts telling them these myths is because at the very, very beginning of the novel, she's standing in the linen closet listening to her husband tell them bedtime stories, and she's listening to them laugh with him in this way that they just don't laugh with her. And this instills in her this kind of jealousy and this, you know, curiosity about what it is about him that they maybe like better. And so she starts infusing their bedtime stories with these Chinese myths in an attempt to get them to, you know, fall in love with their shared culture. And I wanted to pay homage to my mom and to my grandmother in including all these stories that made me want to be a writer.
What was interesting to me about her husband's stories and then her telling her own the stories as she remembered them, but not checking on them to make sure they were actually accurate, quote unquote, right, is that you're opening this door to sort of fan fiction in your novel, right? They don't have to be the exact stories, right? We can mash up Peter Pan and, you know, Snow White or whatever it is, and we can do that with the Chinese equivalent. This is how I sort of remember it, and if I don't quite get it, I'm going to just add this. And I think fan fiction, well, first of all, is having a moment, but also has been for a long time. And I liked that you wove that in there.
Yeah. Something else that my mom used to do that is very much like akin to fan fiction, I think, is she would tell me a story and then she would say, okay, your turn. You tell me a story now. And I think getting to exercise that creative muscle at such a young age is completely the reason that I wanted to be a writer from like the time I was like 3 years old onward. She's telling these myths as she remembers them, like you were saying. Sam is kind of plopping different characters from different fairy tales into his stories. And the way that this kind of circles back in the narrative of her life is she's realizing that she's been holding on to all these stories and the myths of her marriage in a way that is no longer serving her. And I think, if anything, the big thing I want readers to come away from this book is this feeling that you can retell the story of your life at any point in any way that you want to.
You emphasize that also in the origin stories. And this is a moment for your narrator, right? The origin of a relationship, right? So you have the bedtime stories, you have the story of how your marriage or your life is going, but this origin story seems to be really important to the narrator. What's your meet cute? How did you get together? How did this start? Talk to us about that origin story and the role that plays in the book.
I think as a culture, we're so obsessed with beginnings, right? Anytime, you know, a friend brings a new, you know, guy over to dinner, we're like, oh, tell us the story of how you met, right? We really want to know the beginning of things. But I think sometimes we hold on to meet cutes and origin stories that no longer serve us. You know, personally, I dated this guy for way longer than I should have, just because we met on the Q train and I was reading a book and he asked me what I was reading. And I was like, this is it. Like, this is the story that I want to tell forever. And, you know, that That's crazy. You can't hold on to things just because they begin in like a really fairy tale way.
You write very deeply about cancer, cancer diagnosis, treatment, divorce, but these aren't necessarily things that you've experienced firsthand. How did you really dig into these experiences, these emotions, so you could put them on the page so deeply?
Breast cancer is unfortunately something that runs in my family. My mother has had it twice, my grandmother as well. And while it's not something that I, you know, have firsthand experience with, I have been in a lot of these rooms, you know, holding their hand, you know, with them. I've been in the waiting room with them. I've been in the exam room with them. I basically go as far as they let you go before they say, please, you can't come into this final testing room. And I think I wanted to, just honor their stories with this one. And I, again, thinking about all the weird details that you kind of garner of a person or of a place, I was looking for somewhere to put my complaints about how small the paper cups are in waiting rooms and how outdated the magazines are. So I think that's where some of that texture comes in, particularly in the waiting room of these hospitals. The divorce part of the novel, I was definitely going through some very minor heartbreak at the time that this started as a short story. And because I'm a Scorpio, I really wanted to raise the emotional stakes. So instead of a breakup, let's make it a divorce, I think is where that came in. And then the kids were honestly the biggest surprise to me. And I felt a lot of imposter syndrome putting this book into the world without having, you know, become a mother myself. Two things started happening really as I was writing this novel more seriously. The first being that I hit my late 20s and my boyfriend and I moved in together, and I was getting all these questions about when we were going to get married and when we were going to have children. And then the other thing that happened is the pandemic, and with it came all this violence against Asian Americans here in New York City, a place that I've always felt safe, and also, you know, all over the world. And I think these two things happening kind of in tandem with one another really forced me to think about if I wanted to or if I could bring children into the world who looked like me, who I couldn't protect from, you know, senseless violence, from racism, from illness, from divorce. And that's kind of where the motherhood bit came in, but it did really surprise me. And for me, I'm still very much on the fence about motherhood, but I wanted to write about being a mother as a way to sit with that feeling on the page, right? More than, you know, does childbirth hurt? Or, you know, like, I feel like, you know, when you don't have kids and you're thinking about having kids, that's kind of like the first question. Like, how much does it hurt? It's like the first question that everyone has. And I wanted to kind of sit with it a couple years beyond that, right? What does it feel like to be checking on their homework when you're really tired and the dishes haven't been done, but you're looking at the way that their handwriting is changing? You know, what happens if they maybe favor your partner over you? How does that feel? I basically just put all of my fears and anxieties and hopes and dreams about what motherhood might look like onto the page.
So I really wanted to talk to you about this, that you're writing about the experience of motherhood and these, you know, some of these other things that you don't have firsthand, because a lot of writing teachers and courses always say, write what you know. Right? Don't write somebody else's story, write your own. And yet we read books in order to sympathize, empathize, to get into other worlds. And I always go back and forth on this. Like, why can you only write about what you know? Why can't you write about other things that you're imagining? Maybe you don't have them 100% right, but maybe you're opening windows and doors for other people that wouldn't otherwise be open.
Yeah, I think what we expect a lot of the time, especially from someone's like debut novel, is that it's like basically autofiction. I feel like I've been walking into a lot of rooms lately and people will have like read the book but have no idea like what I look like or, you know, who I am. And I come into this room and they kind of go, huh, you're not what we were expecting. And I think that's maybe because, I mean, my maybe like tin hat theory about this is because of cancel culture. Like, I think people are just so afraid of getting it wrong. And so it maybe feels safest or more comfortable to write only from their own experience, because at least they can be like, well, this was my like lived experience. And so it's not wrong. And I don't know, for me, exactly like you said, like the reason I read and also the reason I write is to understand, you know, things that are beyond my own lived experience.
Katie, why was this the book that you wanted to write?
Wow, that is a great question. I, you know, like I said, I had started with a lot of short stories before this, and I thought, like, my first book that I hoped to put into the world would maybe be a short story collection. But Maggie was just so different from everything that I had written before, but also in a way that felt really true to me. So even though I hadn't, you know, lived any of this experience for myself, and the plot of my life does not follow, you know, the contours of our narrator's life, I have put so much of myself and my love of storytelling and, you know, all of my loved ones into it. I think, like I said earlier, I wanted to honor the stories of my mom and my grandmother, you know, their experience with breast cancer, and also the way that they made me fall in love with storytelling, right, in the myths that they told me growing up. I wanted to honor the role, the vital role that a best friend can play in your life by putting bits and pieces of all of my best friends into it. And I think Maggie was just kind of the perfect first book for me because she's kind of this love letter to storytelling and to the people that we share stories with.
Katie Yee, thank you so much for joining me today on Check This Out.
Rachel, thank you so much for having me. This was a blast.
It really was. I love talking to you. I hope we'll stay in touch and we get to read more. I'm Rachel Barenbaum.
You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. Next up, I have Vanessa Lilly. We are going to talk about her brand new Sid Walker novel, The Bone Thief. Vanessa Lilly's Blood Sisters was my number one reading suggestion back on our holiday show in 2023. In that novel, we met Sid Walker, a Cherokee archaeologist working for the Bureau of Indian Affairs, who was summoned to rural Oklahoma to investigate the disappearance of two women, one of them who turned out to be her sister. That book went on to become a USA Today bestseller and was named one of the best mystery novels of the year by The Washington Post and Amazon. And today, I'm so excited to welcome Vanessa back on the show for the sequel to that amazing first book, The Blood Sisters. The sequel is called The Bone Thief. And again, we get to meet the main character, Sid Walker. She's back investigating another murder, and this time we're much closer to home. We're actually in Rhode Island. Vanessa, welcome to Check This Out.
Hi, Rachel. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
I'm so excited to have you here today to talk about The Bone Thief and to bring me back to Sid Walker. So tell me, what is this book about?
Sid Walker is back, and she's in Rhodey. So she is back where she lives now with her wife, her pregnant wife, and she's called to a wealthy kids camp because some remains tied to the Great Swamp Massacre, which some of your listeners may be familiar with, which happened between colonists and the Narragansett tribe. And some remains are found connected to that, and then they're stolen. And so she's drawn in investigating those remains. Meanwhile, there is a native Narragansett teenage girl missing. And all of this seems to be tied to a mysterious secret society called the Founders Club, where members can track their lineage all the way back to the Mayflower. So lots of intrigue and twists are ahead for Sid Walker.
And these remains that were found, they're very old?
Very, yeah. The Great Swamp Massacre happened between the colonists and the Narragansett tribe. And so she uses her archaeology skills, her historical skills, but also investigates the actual legacy of the tribes, as well as the connection to the history of Rhode Island, which was so fascinating to research. I'm a big truth and fiction writer. I love to incorporate real history. Even though it's a contemporary thriller, there's plenty of history that I liked learning about and love sharing with readers.
Like, what kind of history is in here that we're going to learn about?
Well, you know, I think, you know, being a Cherokee woman from Oklahoma, I'm always sort of thinking about the echoes of history. My family was on the Trail of Tears. That's why we ended up in Oklahoma from Tennessee. But being Oklahoma Cherokee is really different than Narragansett, Rhode Island, right? They're on land they've been in time immemorial. So as a writer, I thought about their lived experience here and living in a place where for thousands of years, they've had the same plants, the same medicine. So the story even opens not only with the Great Swamp Massacre, which is, of course, a real historical event, but also the powwow, which is the oldest continuous powwow in the country, is right here in Rhode Island. 350 years. I was just at it 2 months ago that they have been meeting and gathering together. In fact, powwow is a Narragansett word. And from there, we look at the Great Swamp Massacre. But then, because this is sort of a more of a contemporary story, I include something some of your listeners may remember, which is the smoke shop raid, because to me, you know, history is an echo. And some of the echo of the Great Swamp Massacre, I think, echoes in the smoke shop raid. And certainly, again, as a Cherokee woman thinking about, well, how did the echoes of maybe the Great Swamp Massacre echo with the Trail of Tears? So, you know, it is a twisty, turny thriller, but history is all around us and it informs how we are in the world. So I loved just thinking about the different ways that this intersects in our kind of contemporary lives.
This is one of my favorite things about your books is you give me so much history when I read your books. And yet there's also all of this, you know, suspense and there's the thriller element. There's, you know, it's a good old whodunit murder mystery. And yet it's plopped down in the middle of history. Let's talk about Sid Walker for a minute. Let's go back to her. So she's an archaeologist and she's working for the Bureau of Indian Affairs. How does she end up working on a murder, right? At first, you know, at first glance, when I first saw that, you know, I was like, what? How does that work out? Tell me about Sid.
Yeah, so Sid is very driven by justice, which when you're creating a character, you want to give them certain attributes. That's really an engine for the plot. And so Sid Walker is all about justice. And there's different justice, right? There's sort of justice with your own moral and ethical code. And then there's like justice within the Bureau of Indian Affairs, you know, which is a part of the government, which has a really complicated and oftentimes really terrible history with Indigenous communities. And so she's, you know, conflicted, which is great for a character. She's in two worlds. And so building her, I knew that in the pursuit of justice, it being a thriller, you know, particularly around the missing and murdered Indigenous women piece, which, you know, thank God we have a language around it. We're talking about it. We're elevating these stories. So what would those missing stories look like? And this story opens with a historical murder with these remains. But then there's also this fear that there's been another crime against a teenage girl. And so she's hopefully going to find her safe and sound. But there's a question of whether or not that's true. And then there's some other kind of complicated people missing, you know, that also unfold as part of the narrative about who we're connected to and how history is impacting us where we're at. And so Sid gets drawn in and her sense of justice keeps her very engaged.
Vanessa, I want to go back to something earlier that you talked about, the smoke shop raid. I don't know if everyone's familiar with it. It was certainly, I'm embarrassed to say, something that was newer to me. Could you talk about the smoke shop raid and tell us what that is?
Absolutely. So in 2005, the governor of Rhode Island wanted to stop the Narragansett tribe from having tax-free cigarettes on their own sovereign land. And normally that would be a ticket, like a small fine, but the governor wanted to really smash his boot. And so he sent his state troopers in to raid the smoke shop. It was violent. People were injured. And that was sort of a midpoint in my book, because to me, the smoke shop raid really echoes the Great Swamp Massacre. So it's this idea of unhealed history is continuing to echo. It's about sovereignty. It's about the government coming in and stopping the progress within a tribe, the safety within a tribe. And to this day, the Great Swamp Massacre, as well as a smoke shop raid, are annually mourned by the tribe.
Wow. Wow. I mean, here, this is where Sid Walker is hard hitting, right? And we really get to this real history. What was it like to come back to her for a second book?
It was great. This next book picks up right after the other one. So she's about to become a new mom. So she's still got a little growing to do, which I took from my own experience of needing to grow up a little before I became a parent. And I loved writing about Rhode Island. I've been here since 2011. You know, I feel very lucky and honored to have friends within the Narragansett community, to go to events, including the powwow, but other amazing cultural events. So to share, you know, a lot of people aren't aware of the Narragansett tribe. And so to be able to just share a little bit of what I've learned within the pages of this book, of course, with my main character's perspective, but certainly to let people be connected, I hope, to the resiliency. I mean, they have been here since the first boats came over and they are still here. And so it was really exciting to share that, you know, within a thriller.
Yeah, so why the thriller? Why is that the lens that you choose?
So write what you read is the age-old advice, and I mostly read thrillers, and so I've actually tried to write non-thrillers before, and God, they're not good. I always go back to a thriller, and a little more seriously, why I think that's true is because to me, a thriller is the most intense moment in a person's life. It's when everything is at stake. It's when you see the systems around them. So do they have the support of the police or do they not? Do they have the support of their community? Who in their home can they trust? It's when everything sort of collides and you see them at their best and at their worst. And thrillers really lend themselves to pushing characters as far as they can possibly go. And I do love a page turner. So thrillers do that as well. They're doing their job.
Who doesn't love a page turner? You mentioned the Founders Society. I want to go back to that. What is that? Let's talk a little bit more about it.
Yeah. So for me, that was an opportunity to think about the question of like, what does modern colonialism look like? I mean, we are in New England. This is the birthplace of colonialism. This is where the matrix of America was built. And so as someone not from here, who's lived here since 2011, I sort of thought about what does it mean to live in this place where this was founded? So the Founders Society is a combination of a couple things that I thought were interesting. It's almost more of a literary experiment. It's this idea of, well, certainly a country club, right? It's an exclusive place. And country clubs were founded in New England. The first ones were in Boston. And then there is the question of, you know, who would belong and, you know, sort of protecting your own, right? That is this idea of colonialism. It's protecting those who sort of look like you, maybe have the same religious affiliation. And then you've got the same doctors, the same lawyers, the same schools, the same kind of cars, the same points of view, and you protect your own. And so it was sort of an opportunity to really think about the Founder Society and then tying them back to the Mayflower, because my questions are around colonialism and how generation after generation, you know, those resources have been able to be contained. And of course, it's a secret society because you got to have fun while you're reading. And so there's a lot of mystery and some creepy stuff that happens. And all of it is tied into this idea of indigenous remains, which is an ongoing debate and conversation about remains, funerary items, because they're still on shelves. They're still on shelves in museums. They're still on shelves in universities and even in people's private homes and collections. And so I wanted to really explore some of these questions. And it's not just indigenous, right? We have mummies in museums. Like, what does it mean that we pull people out of the ground and we put them on shelves? Like, what does that say about us as a culture and a people? And who is doing the telling of those narratives, right? When you go to an exhibit and there's remains of a mummy, is it an Egyptian? Did an Egyptian person write the narrative or is it a white lens? And so I just think that some of those questions are naturally tied into the indigenous community because for so long, our remains have been viewed as something that can be on a museum shelf, but also other cultures. And I think it says a lot about kind of who we are as a country, even about how we treat those after they passed.
So we have Sid Walker as our sort of guide through a lot of these questions and through the entire book, The Bone Thief, and of course through the first one, Blood Sisters. What is it that you want her character? Why did you choose her as the character, the lens into the story and into all of these issues? What is it that you want us to take away from her?
For me, Sid, the kind of most important factor for Sid, aside from that pursuit of justice, which makes her a compelling character, is actually that she had a bit of my background because there are so few Indigenous writers being published. It's gotten a little better, but there's a handful of us. And so I knew that if I was going to, you know, publishing is a table and there are just only so many seats. And I knew if I was going to take a seat at the table, she needed to really have my background. I would never write a character who has a Narragansett background. That's not my point of view. And I want a Narragansett person to take that seat at the table. So she is white presenting. She is from Northeastern Oklahoma. I even gave her the last name of my family, Walker, which they were on the Trail of Tears. You know, being from Northeastern Oklahoma, I gave her a lot of, she's two-spirit like me. I just felt like I want to take a very precise seat at this table that is my background that feels appropriate. And so her lens, even though she's very different than me, her lens is my lens. And so what I am sharing with people feels not only authentic, but appropriate because I'm not telling someone else's story. And of course, people, you know, I get asked, like, can I write up other characters of other backgrounds, of faiths, colors? Of course, you know, but you do your research. But for me, I felt like because there are so few Indigenous stories published, it was really important for me to be in my lane of experience. And then hopefully that allows others to sit at the table with their own experiences.
Vanessa Lilly, I'm so excited for you for The Bone Thief. Thank you so much for joining me today on Check This Out.
Such a pleasure to see you, Rachel. Thank you all so much.
Vanessa, I also really love talking to you, and I loved talking to Katie Yee earlier about her debut, Maggie, or A Man and a Woman Walk into a Bar.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum, author of the novels A Bend in the Stars and Atomic Anna. You've been listening to Check This Out, a show where I get to do one of my favorite things in the world, talk to other writers about their brand new books. Check This Out is a partnership between New Hampshire Public Radio and the Penn Faulkner Foundation. I'll be back next week with another new author you should not miss. Our producer is Jessica Hunt, and NHPR's program director is Emily Quirk. Our partner, the Penn Faulkner Foundation's mission is to champion the breadth and power of fiction in America. The show is sponsored by CNS Wholesale Grocers Family of Companies, the podcast Totally Booked with Zibby and Zibby's Bookshop, and the Jack and Dorothy Byrne Foundation. Remember to go to your local library or bookstore and check out all the books that we're talking about this season. Thank you so much for listening. Read on.